It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. So good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 130th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The URLs for the previous 129 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. Then Westchester Guardian is WESTCHESTERGUARDIAN. It includes the 199th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the columns, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. At the website mentioned earlier, you'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper at my web home. Try it and subscribe. It's free and only one email per day, www.johnmack13.com. Next week's guest will be former New York Times innovation columnist and author of the recently published Innovationology, Peggy Kennedy. She will be followed on subsequent Sundays by New York Daily News columnist Dennis Hamill and Gail Lumet Buckley, author of another recent book, The Black Calhoun from Civil War to Civil Rights, with an African-American family. I hope you'll join us for all of those shows. Then up to this show, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I hold the participation of callers until near the end of my conversation with my guest. My guest tonight is radio veteran and weekend late night host on Boston WBZ, that's AM 1030, Jordan Rich. So I'm a longtime radio junkie and listen to BZ regularly when my wife was director of academic technology at Tufts University, and would occasionally call in to the overnight show. And when she returned to New York and we gave up the Medford apartment, I could still pick up BZ at night on one of my portable radios and would listen when I could. With the advent of the TuneIn and Hot Radio apps, my listening to BC became the regular thing once I heard Jordan Weekend Show, then I've become the quasi-regular caller. So, good night. Good evening, Jordan, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Good evening to you. It's great to talk to you from this end.
But let's start at the beginning. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
Sure. I'm a Boston kid. I grew up in the suburbs of Boston, a little south of the city, and went to a little college called Curry College, which was at the time about 800 students. It's now a bit bigger. Majored in communications and got my start right at the junior year in college. I got a chance to work at a major station as sort of an inside baseball kind of pitch, and I took it and haven't looked back.
What were your early memories of radio?
Well, like you, I'm a radio fan first and foremost, and I think most of us who grew up with a transistor and listening under the covers to baseball games or long distance radio stations really dig the idea of connecting to people via this medium. So for me, it was a love of the medium and the fact that I was a theater kid in high school. I loved performing, and we had a little radio club in high school, and that was what triggered the idea to try broadcasting as opposed to theater. I still love theater, but it's not something that I wanted to pursue. And hence Curry College, and met some great people, and many of whom became mentors, and that set me on my way. But it's really a love of the art of the radio that I think has propelled me to move forward.
I went through three ages of radio, the dramas and the comedies with the Lone Ranger, The Shadow, and Jack Benny, then Then the music with Alan Freed and Cousin Brucey and Murder K in New York and then talk radio. Where did you come in along that spectrum?
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit younger, but we're all, you know, in the same family. I started probably in the early to mid-60s, and in Boston, by that time, most of the dramas and comedies were done with, but my early sort of hooks, the things that I really got into, included music shows with some longtime Boston disc jockeys who were just legendary, and talk shows. I actually was a kid at, what, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and I loved hearing people talk, as you and I are doing now. And I was fascinated by people calling in and talking to somebody about anything. And so I would listen. That was my first entree to radio. And again, I mentioned it earlier, but baseball and listening under the covers to Red Sox games from late night, and I should have been in bed asleep, but it was the magic of seeing the game in front of me and that use of imagination that really turned me on. So I would say the early to mid-60s, post-dramas, talk shows just starting, and baseball games, and a little bit of music, including a great jazz show, which I can talk about later, that was hosted by the fellow I followed at WBZ, Norm Nathan.
The first talk show I remember in New York was a film named Barry Gray, who was on for years. But mm-hmm. a lot of people that attribute the earliest talk show to Bob Grant, when it was out on the West Coast. Who do you remember?
Well, again, I grew up here in Boston, so I would be listening to the local guys. We had certain names that may be familiar to your listeners. Jerry Williams was one. He worked in various markets. The fellas who worked at a radio station that's now a sports station, but at the time was talk, was WEEI, and the names that I'll just throw out there, Howard Nelson and Jim Westover and Mark Lawrence, I think. And these guys were Paul Benziquin. These were state-of-the-art talk show. They called them talk masters back then. And so I was listening to those kinds of things. And then I would do what a lot of people who love radio, I would listen at night to stations, including those in New York. And you would know this name, Long John Nebbele.
Oh, sure.
I guess. Yeah, I used to tune him in on the weekends. And Barry Farber, who has over the years become a friend of mine, a long-distance friend, another great New York talent and a Southern drawl, but a beautiful man and a great, great talent. I became a fan of his. I did get a chance to listen to Gene Shepherd, mostly on tape, and I fell in love with that whole style of talk and imagination. So those are the guys I was really tuning into.
Shepherd was wonderful, and I met Barry Farber when I was the president of the New York Apple User Group in New York. He and his wife would come to the meeting. She was into personal computers, so mm-hmm. he would come. Mm-hmm. So he'd come. But Shepherd was terrific, and then of course he went on to the movie writing career and to other things. I know that WBZ with its three-character call sign goes back a long way, but such as Detroit's WJR, Chicago's WGN, then New York's WOR. Do you know much about BZ's history? And if so, please tell us about
it. Sure. WBZ is considered the second oldest commercial station in the country, from what I'm told and from what I've read and the history that I've discovered, John. And the other station, of course, is KDKA that precedes it. For years, a sister station. But WBZ went on the air actually out of Springfield originally, and there were two WBZs. There was a WBZ in Boston, a WBZA in Springfield, and then ultimately, you know, formed one. And it was, even at the beginning of its time, as you mentioned, those other three-letter calls, a very powerful 50,000-watt signal that would sign on at 50,000 and stay there. As you know, in radio, traditional radio stations sign off or sign down and power down at night so that their signals don't all jumble up. But BZ and GN and OR, they are allowed by FCC law to stay at full power. And it was done back in the old days, John, as you know, to create a defense network in case something drastic happened. In those days, pre-internet, we would be able to basically turn on all those stations alone and let the president or whomever come up with a message for the country. So it's got a rich, rich history. It was music for many, many years, big bands in the old, early days, every kind of community show. And then in the early 90s, right around the time of the Gulf War, BZ decided it was time to lose the music. AM and music didn't quite mix, and they went to the talk news format, which we've had now for, well, 25, almost 30 years, and it's still the number one AM station in the area and still doing quite well.
Well, was BZ then originally the Westinghouse station, as it was WJZ in New York, and I think KDKA, wasn't it?
Yes, you're talking about the Westinghouse years, which is even before my time, and they owned it for a gazillion years, and then ultimately, it was purchased by CBS, and of course, the news of late suggests that CBS, the corporate giant, might be looking to sell off some of their radio properties. It's sort of in the news, but nothing firm on that yet, but it's been a CBS O&O, or owned and operated, since the early 90s. But yes, Westinghouse Broadcasting Company, and this everyone in New England knew that name was associated with BZ for decades.
Most of the people that I grew up with, myself included, wound up doing very different things from which they were intended. My son, however, decided that he wanted to be a TV writer when he was in the seventh grade. And that's what he is. But I wonder if it's a generational thing. But you decided early what you wanted. Do you think it's a sign of the times that more people now seem more tightly focused than they were years ago?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. Of course, I've got two children who are through college already, and their choices are still pretty wide and varied, but I think we had a little bit more freedom, if we had the right kind of parents back then, to stake out on our own and try something like radio. Radio has changed so much. I would say that if it were today and I were just starting out, I don't know if I would have wound up where I am or if I'd even be in the same potential place to do what I'm doing, because I came up, as many guys did in my case, the late 70s, early 80s, in what we call the tall grass of radio. And I worked as a DJ, I worked as a weather reporter, I did traffic reports, I did news, I did talk, I did everything. It doesn't happen that way for career-minded people in broadcasting today, so because it's so segmented and so specific, you know, the jobs that are out there. So the greatest boon to people like me and my generation was we could do everything and make mistakes in every area, and then fine-tune what it is we wanted to do. And the one thing about this business, John, is even today, you never quite know where it's going to lead, good or bad. I mean, you don't know whether somebody's going to sell the station out from under you or someone is going to want to hire their number one nephew to take over in the morning, or someone is going to offer you a gig that you didn't even prepare for. So I guess the long and short of it is you open yourself up for possibilities. And if you leave yourself open and you have confidence in your talent, then it's a great, great time. Any time's a great time to be in broadcasting, in my opinion.
When I was in college, and as you mentioned, it was prior to you, I was in the late 50s. I had no clue. I was an English major. The only people who really seemed to be focused, they were the accountants and the engineers. So I was extremely lucky that I wound up in technology for all my working life, and that led me into teaching and to writing and to doing other things. But it seems now that so many students, they get focused at the end of grammar school, and they wind up picking their high school based on what they want to be and on their colleges. It's a different atmosphere because there are more people now than there are jobs. And when
right.
I was getting out, it was just the opposite. I see McPartland, who's been a host of the morning show in San Francisco for a number of years, and he was And he was also did a lot of television on such shows as Inside the Dish and others. Have you done TV? Does it hold any interest for you?
Yes, it's always a question that people in radio get. Have you done or do you want to do TV? And I have done limited work on television, but it's something that I've never been drawn to. And it's not the old joke, he's got a face for radio, which probably applies. But it's really, I find, these days especially, television has changed so much. There aren't local television talk shows anymore as there were when I was a kid growing up in the business. Where people could do what I do on the radio but do it on TV. They're doing it now, as you are, online and on YouTube, which is great, and podcasts have saved the day. But as far as television, no, I've done it. I've done commercials. I've done live telethons. I've done interviews. But I find that it's a restrictive medium for somebody like me in that, you know, you really have to be focused on where the camera is and physically how you look when you're delivering whatever it is you're delivering. Radio is so freeform and so much a part of the imagination that you can do it in your underwear. No, not that I do. Or you can do it without necessarily looking the part. It's all in the mind, and it's creative juices that flow, and it's how you deliver a presentation orally that makes all the difference. That's why I think it's so magical. If somebody came along and said, we'd like to give you a local TV show, maybe put your radio show on TV, I would say, sure, why not? But to sit behind a news desk and just read text, I would probably pass on that. It just doesn't interest me at this point in my career.
A lot of that has been done on the sports talk shows in New York, where the primary interface with the listener is on the radio, but they're simulcast in the case of Michael Kay, who's the Yankee announcer, on the Yes Radio Network, and on the case of some other people, they're on the ESPN2 or ESPN3. But I don't know of anyone other than the local station, like the Cablevision outlet locally, that actually has talk shows other than the sports shows on.
Yeah, I don't know about New York, but in our, let's say, the 60s and 70s in Boston, we had several programs on television that were very much like the shows you'll see, the Ellen Show or Oprah even. They were local, and you'd have local community leaders, and you'd have interesting people in the community. You'd have occasional celebrities. And it was really a time when you could use the television medium and really explore and interview people at depth and have a lot of fun. But that all went away, went away with budget cuts and changes in format and the advent of cable. So it's changed. You're right, there are shows on the radio that are then simulcast on TV. And I like that. I think that's kind of neat for people to peer in. And they haven't offered that to me at my time slot, which is probably a good thing because you wouldn't want to see me at 3 a.m. unshaven. But it is fascinating to put a picture to the words, and I would consider doing something like that.
One of the earliest in New York that was not the sports show was when Imus was on WABC in New York, and he was simulcast through the MSNBC network. But then when he got in trouble, he got dropped by both, and simulcast after that was on something like Fox 3 that nobody watched. So you mentioned your son's being out of college. I know that Andrew is your TV producer. I mean, your radio producer. Is he in the business beyond that, or is that only working with you?
Well, you know, it's funny. My son Andrew, who I talk about all the time because he's there answering the phones and running the board and doing all the things that a producer does, is a very, and I say this knowing that I'm his dad, but you'll accept it in the spirit it's given. He's a very bright young man who really has a knack for writing, and he really loved it so much that he majored in it. He went to Connecticut College, which was a fine institution in New London, and he majored in creative writing. And when he came out of school last May, for about a month, he was applying everywhere as a writer even as a script writer or an editor, and he really was having trouble. And a couple of jobs opened up. A couple of guys had left who were important to the scene. And I said to first the boss at the station, I said, would you be interested in chatting with my son? He's got some experience doing college radio and he's pretty bright. And they said, yes, we need bodies. Get him in here. So I didn't know how he would take to it, but he's taken to it exceedingly well. And I think two things. One, because he's a young guy who's grown up in the technology, and you're more familiar with technology than I am, John, being in the business, but he's got a knack for it. And everything that the producers do nowadays at a station like ours is digital, is technical, is computer-based. And if you have a good head for that, it's great. But he also turns out to be one really instinctive kid who really understands and gets it. He knows when to fade. He knows when to hit the brake. He knows when to assist me. And, of course, I'm his father, so it probably helps we have that connection. But he's very, very quick and doesn't panic under pressure. So all the elements that make for a great producer. And to answer your question further, he works during the week as well as a news producer. So he's getting into writing. Eventually, if he hangs in there and does what he can, he'll be able to do more writing in the news area. But it's working out great, and what a joy it is to work with my son every single weekend. That's a real kick.
After 18 years as the morning show host, you became both the weekend late night of WBZ and the host producer for many of their specialty shows. Along the way, you also became the co-owner of Chart Productions, Inc., an audio production company, and the teacher to fledgling voiceover people. Tell us about the non-area work that would led
sure.
you to branch out like that.
Well, I'll tell you that the nice thing about going to the school I went to is I was able to hook up with a guy who's been my partner and my pal ever since. And he and I were classmates together, and we formed this little company. Now, at first, we were just doing mobile DJ work and just thinking out loud that we'd love to be able to do creative commercial production, which is something that, for those people who don't understand what I'm saying, it's basically crafting, writing, and recording commercials and narrations for clients. And we had no experience. We just learned at the school station how to put things together. And one thing led to another. We started this business, and we've been at it ever since 1980. So it's now in its 36th year. So during the week, what I do is book my program, and I'll tell you more about that if you want. And I also run my business, which is involved in production of audio and video, which includes commercials. It also involves working with businesses who want narration work done for their products. And I also teach, and I can elaborate if you want, but I teach folks the art, if you will, of voiceover.
Now, you also have the specialty shows on BZ, don't you, during the week also?
Well, yeah, they came to me many years ago. And one of the things that I bring to the table, and it's just who I am, is I'm not just a talk guy. I've done everything. I've been a DJ. I've been a sort of a news public affairs person. I'm also a producer in my own right, so I know how to record and edit and produce audio. So the station had a couple of needs, and one of them was this wonderful feature we do every weekend, six times a weekend during the morning drive shows, all pre-recorded, called New England Weekend, which is simply an opportunity for people to be interviewed by me and in 2 minutes talk about an event coming up or a cultural moment or something. And it's amazing. There are thousands of people who respond to these little vignettes. So that I've been doing for, 12, almost 15 years. And then about 8-9 years ago, the station wanted to put together a food and wine and restaurant piece, just a daily feature. So we came up with the idea. They approached me, and I said, well, what if we have regular co-hosts? I'll interview them. I'll put them all together, and we'll call it, it was a name we all came up with, Connoisseur's Corner. So I'm in Boston, the guy who people turn to for advice on restaurants and wine. I really rely on the knowledge of my co-hosts. They're the ones who do it all. But it's been working out really well, and the station loves it. And everywhere I go, people ask me for a wine selection, and I tell them, I really don't know that much about wine, so you'll have to listen to the show. So that's how that works.
The great mystery writer, Mary Higgins Clark, began her her commercial writing career writing bits for programs like The Green Grocer and those that used to appear like on the CBS network. So that's been around for a while.
And I've interviewed her too, interestingly enough. I didn't know that about her.
I have too. She's a wonderful person. She's just terrific. Tell me about voiceovers. You mentioned that that you could talk about that, both the voiceovers and the teaching. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, voiceover is a term of art, and it has to do with those people who do everything from movie trailers to the commercials you hear on the local radio and TV to, and you open up a website and you hear a voice introducing the site and introducing the concept. You sit in a room with fellow coworkers and you learn about your 401k, and there's a slide or a video and a voice talking to you. That's what I do. I've been doing that since I was in college. I really enjoy it. It's as much fun as being on live, because it's a creative process, and there's so much to the human voice that I've studied over the years, texture and tone and pitch and tempo and all the things that make for a great song, great musical instrument, the voice can also make that kind of connection with the human mind. So I love it. I absolutely love it. And as far as teaching, I would really call it voice acting. It's interesting. People come to me a lot and their first words are this: oh, I really want to talk to you about doing this, because people tell me all the time, I've got a great voice for radio. And I say, you know, you probably do, but let's see how you react reading the words that someone else wrote. Because what we do as voice actors is take the words and the scripts that other people have written and make them our own. And that's sort of a magical thing. A lot of people can do it. Some people have trouble with it. So my goal when I'm teaching is to try to get people to understand the concept that this is supposed to be told and not read. And then we work on the voice and the inflection, but it's really about that connection that we have to make. I hope I'm not going too far afield here, but it's a fascinating art form.
I'm interested. There was a fellow that did them in the New York area whose voice I recognize all the time. The fellow named George Flowers. He did some national things too on the ABC network.
Mm-hmm.
When I mentioned earlier that I used to listen to WDZ when we were up in Medford, the fellow that had the nightly show during the weeks, name began with David, and I can't remember his last name. And he was terrific.
On BZ. Yeah, that would be David Brudnoy. Is that the one?
Oh,
you're
talking
right.
About? Yeah, he was terrific.
Yeah. David Brudnoy, for many in New England, a legendary personality. But David Brudnoy was a unique specimen when it comes to talk radio. He was he had two doctorates, one in language and one in, I believe, political science. And he was a brilliant, brilliant scholar. He had done some teaching, and then he found his way into radio, filling in for someone. And people really took to him. He was very erudite and as brilliant as he was, and he could argue any point his way. He was always pretty respectful and also used language the way language should be used. So David worked for BZ for many, many years. And in the early to mid-90s, he took ill. And at the time, no one really knew what the issue was. And he came back and told the audience and told pretty much the world that he was coming out of the closet. He had contracted HIV and was very open about it. And people in New England rallied around him. And, people sometimes say, John, that, well, Bostonians are a little bit closed-minded and all, but it was a beautiful thing to see. And he came back did many more years, and then finally succumbed to cancer in the mid-2000s when, you know, he just couldn't go on anymore. And he was a prolific, brilliant, erudite person, very opinionated, but always treated people who were respectful with respect. And I learned a ton from him, just a ton.
I remember that he both had strong opinions, but he was respectful of other people.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you mention one night on the show that you've come to value your regular sleeping pattern more than you ever did, and you do a regular schedule except for the weekends. Do you see yourself giving up the nighttime to work at some point?
That's the question I get more than any other, John. And I've been doing this now at BZ for 20 years. And I'll tell you that people say, well, you must hate it, you know, having to be up all night. And when do you sleep on the weekend? And I usually say the same thing. No, I don't hate it. In fact, I've gotten so used to it. And I'm not a guy who goes home after the show and sleep all day. I do not get up at 4 in the afternoon and then start my day. I purposely sleep less and take naps so that I can be fresh and also not lose my rhythm during the week. But I will say this, having done morning radio for another 18 years at different places, meaning getting up at 3 or 3:30 or 4, that is so much harder on the body. The body just does not want to get out of bed, no matter when you go to bed. Does not want to get out of bed at 3:45 in the morning. It's just circadian rhythm time. It's just not the time to do it. So when I gave that up, my life changed for the better. And also I would say that I've learned very much over the years that as strong as I am for a little guy, I really have to pace myself. We're all human, and we all run into these stone walls when we push too much. So I'm really careful about getting enough sleep during the week and getting those naps. It's critical.
My son was a Howard Stern fan, and I remember Howard Stern saying that people were always asking him to things at night and to parties, but he went to sleep at 6:30 every night, you know, when he was doing the
morning
shows.
And guys I know in the business, you know, big names, none of them feel great because they have to worry about getting to sleep early enough. They miss a lot of things. Granted, it's the most glamorous time and the highest paying, you know, highest billing time, but it just does a number on you getting up at that time, and then when you go on vacation, you're completely off schedule, and then you have to relearn it when you come back. So it's not something that's top of my list in terms of wanting to work. I actually don't mind doing the late night show. Although today, I'm talking to you today. I was telling you this off the air. I'm really dragging a little bit because I didn't sleep much to get to the South Boston Irish Parade early enough so I could get into South Boston. So I had to sacrifice a couple of hours of extra sleep, but I'll make it.
Is that always the Sunday after St. Patrick's Day?
Yes. They.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys in New York, I think your parade is certainly huge, but it's always on the Sunday after, sometimes before, but usually after. And it's just a big old, you know, politicians shaking hands, kissing babies party. And it's very unique to Boston, very unique.
I listened to the show last night, as I mentioned, the food show. And you've mentioned that you have just recently gotten into cooking, and that would surprise many who knew you. Got you into cooking, then why would that surprise people?
Well, my personal story is known to my audience, and I guess I can just, for your audience's benefit, and they don't know me maybe, and I'll just give them a quick once-over. I was married for 31 years to a wonderful woman, and she was sick for many of those years, particularly the last few, and passed away in 2013. So I became a widower. Prior to that, in terms of cooking and doing things, I really didn't do much of anything. I attended to my work and kind of left everything else to other people. I've since met a beautiful, wonderful lady who's soon to be my wife. I'm very excited about that. And she happens to be a great cook, but she also happens to have an amazing array of kitchenware and ideas, and she's very creative. And I said, on Valentine's Day, let me cook for you. Let me try it. I don't know if I'll succeed, but I really want to do something special for you. Okay. So I didn't blow it. I actually didn't poison anybody, and it went pretty well. So since then, I've sort of taken on, not every weekend, because sometimes I just don't have the time, but the Sunday cooking deal, and it's turning out to be fun. And John, my favorite attendant and helper and assistant is YouTube. I just open up the computer and check out how to grill fish or marinate chicken, and there it is.
And what was your first meal that you cooked?
First meal was pretty industrious. I heard about this, I've seen it in restaurants, and I thought, well, this looks like it might be fun and a nice presentation. It's called fish baked in parchment, and you buy this parchment paper, and you take the paper, and you wrap the fish in it, and you steam it, and you're done. It sounds easy. I went through almost an entire roll of parchment paper, which is pretty big, because I couldn't figure out how to cut it properly and make it wrap well, and oh my God. But she didn't know that. She was out of the house. So I pulled it off, and I figured, one under my belt, let's go for two. Two led to three, and I think I'm up to five. Six, rather limited success, meaning I screwed a few things up, but nothing that's earth-shattering or death-defying.
I've heard you occasionally make political comments, or ask a guest a political question, but I haven't heard, maybe I just miss it, a hard political show would say the head of the Massachusetts Democratic or Republican Party, or both of them together. Have I just missed them?
Intentionally, my role, and it's a role that I inherited in the late night, and not that our late night, we have a full-time late night guy who works during the week, and he's more issue-oriented, of course, but it's always been on the weekend sort of a respite to not talk about or argue about politics per se. Now, I do have opinions, and I'm happy to share them with anybody when they call in, but because the guy who precedes me, Dan Ray, is such a wonderful commentator, and he covers all this stuff so well, we always feel that it's time for a break. So whether it's a humorous break or a break with an interview about spirituality or anything that's different, I love to take that on. So we purposely downplay the political and the argumentative stuff in favor of the I like to say the eclectic, the things that people don't often hear on a talk show. So that is purposeful.
So what about as this crazy campaign heats up, even more, though, do you think you'll be doing more of it?
Yeah, it's already crept up. I mean, I've never seen anything like this. Most people agree. And what I've focused on a little bit is just not the policy, because that's kind of vague, but the personalities and the infotainment approach to politics and getting some very interesting reactions. I mean, I have reacted to what I've heard and gotten people to comment. What I don't like is when people scream and argue and hang up on each other, because we get absolutely nowhere. It's just theatrics. And so I try to raise questions that are a little bit more, shall we say, that human, that deal with the human elements of politics. You can answer this question for me, John. I'll throw this back to you. Having done many, many hours yourself and also watched cable news shows and chat shows, have you ever seen anyone argue and change their mind because of the other argument?
The only things I remember like that on television, if you went back to David Susskind's open end or to William F. Buckley's firing line, where people had the chance to present opinions, and then you could listen, and you could say, "Oh yeah, gee, maybe I should think about that." But you don't have that anymore. You have 10-minute blurbs or 10-second blurbs that are the news bites, and I really think we've lost because of that. You know,
I agree. I think the emphasis on, I keep coming back to theatrics. I mean, it's all about ratings, grabbing attention. And the loudest voice usually gets the most attention. I do think, though, that you raise an excellent point some of those programs of the past were ideal examples of the good, solid use of broadcast time. David Susskind, I remember very well. William F. Buckley, I remember very well. Even Dick Cavett is one of my all-time heroes, and I've interviewed him twice.
Yeah.
I just think those kinds of conversations, without being, you know, I think you're an idiot and I don't agree with you, you ask the question, well, why do you think this way? And what influences you? And why do you think people are thinking this way? And it just broadens everything. And I think those are the role models that I try to emulate. And also the fact that in most of these cases, these are people who allowed other people to talk, which I think is the great blessing when you have smart people, allow them to interact and talk and be civil, and you'll get a lot more out of it. The audience will get a lot more out of it.
I agree. And you mentioned the Red Sox games earlier. I'm a real sports fan, and I can tell you who was the starting team for 1945 Chicago Cubs or the 1939 New York Yankees and all this, but I can't stand the sports shows in New York when either the Mets or the Yankees or the Giants fans, they call up and they hate the other fans. And they always refer to themselves as we did this. We lost the tough one last night. I always wanted to scream at the radio. I didn't see you on the ice. What position were you playing? You know, and it's just it's a nastiness that's gotten into fandom. Now, as the one team town, do you find that are the sports fans a bit more open to the rest of the world?
You know, we have a similar kind of – we have two sports stations on radio. We have an AM and an FM. The FM is our sister station here at BZ, so it's part of the family. And, yes, the whole idea of the sports format is to rile people up, get them excited, be controversial. And, gosh, there's so much to be controversial about. You may have been familiar with a little something called Inflategate here in Boston with – the Patriots and Brady and all that. This has been going on now for a year, and it's kind of silly when you think about it. It's got nothing to do with the outcome of any games anymore, but it's been going on for well over a year, and it's like constant arguing and bickering and screaming about the NFL, and that's just one thing. And now with the Red Sox starting up, there's always controversy about the Red Sox and who's got too much weight on him and spring training and all that kind of thing. And that's, I can understand that's the goal, is to make it interesting and provocative. But oftentimes fans call in and have really nothing to add except, you know, I think this team stinks. I think this guy should be traded. Okay, fine. Next caller, same thing. So it can be a little bit repetitive. You're right about that, John.
Johnny Most was one of my heroes, and two of the broadcasts that I like the most in New York sports came out of New York, came out of Boston, Ed Coleman and Susan Wolman. And, and they're a little more laid back than the rest of them. I check caller from the 213 area code. Let's see who that is. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Yes, John, this is Frank Hickey. How are you doing?
Hello, Frank Hickey. I'm doing fine. Frank is a very interesting guy, Jordan. He's he, after high school, he traveled around the country, then went to Europe, lived in a cave for a while in Spain, returned to New York, became a private investigator. Then he became an investigator for New York, for the Queens DA's office, then a Manhattan DA's office. Then over the years, he was a cop in Savannah. He was the PI in Thailand and in, I believe, Singapore. And he was LAPD, and he's a writer. So he's been all over the place. And along the way, he found that he has the facility for languages. And then when he came back to the United States, he went, you know, if he hadn't done well in high school, he went to college and got a master's. So he has an interesting background. Frank, what do you have for us?
I was enjoying the show very much, and especially when you were talking about what a tax it takes on you to do a night show and to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I think the public doesn't know how police officers have to work rotating shifts a lot of times and how much that drains you. I didn't discover this until I started working uniform, and I was 37. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, your body says, "Where's the pillow?" And it impacts all your decision-making. It impacts your home life. Nobody knows about this unless they're making the pajamas for the police officer and fixing his breakfast. But then if you're an active cop, you have to go to court the next day.
Right.
And then be back to work the next night.
Frank, you make an excellent point. I mean, and by no means do I equate what I do with the importance of what a police officer or a doctor or a nurse or an EMT, any of these people who are so vital. But you're absolutely right. And not that we're looking for violins here, but it really it's imperative that people understand, you know, sleep deprivation and sleep cycles. I think the American Medical Association says most Americans don't get enough sleep anyway, but we should be shooting for 7 to 8 hours a night, every night. It's very rare that anybody, like you mentioned, can do it. But that's why I think, if you have a little more understanding when you realize people are sometimes a little frayed around the edges, you can understand why.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of stress there.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. That's just something I wanted to comment on. I'm enjoying the show. I'll let the other callers call in, but keep on with it. It's a very interesting show.
Thank you, Frank. Jordan, you were on the evenings when during the pedophile and the Cardinal Cushing was going on, and which is the subject of obviously the movie. What's your memory of that? And did you get involved with that on the radio? Did you have many callers?
Well. Yeah, I remember that. That's it's Cardinal Law, actually, Bernard Law.
Oh, Cardinal Law. Yeah, absolutely.
That's okay. Yeah, and that was an unfolding story that still reverberates today. And I have interviewed probably a half dozen people, either people who are victims or people who have advocated for victims. And I've also, including one gentleman whose name escapes me, who wrote a play. And through his art, was able to talk about this horrendous trauma that impacted so many people. Yes, that was a huge story for months and years. Still, you know, reverberates, as I say. And I think that stories that are that big, that are that huge and impactful, everybody, including me on my show, we end up dealing with it. I remember when 9/11 happened, of course, the biggest story of our lives, perhaps. We didn't veer from 9/11 talk on the late night, overnight weekend shows for 6 months. I mean, it was, and you didn't want to do that because people, A, needed information, and B, just needed to talk, needed to vent. And I think that's a service that radio can provide, talk radio can provide, the opportunity for people to vent and express themselves and let it out a little bit and do so with, you know, a listening, a person on the other end listening. That we found that to be very therapeutic for them and for us.
I should not have mixed up the famed Cardinal Cushing with Cardinal Law. I used to be in regular contact by email with the great Andrew Greeley, the novelist and the Catholic priest and the author. And he, from the very beginning, said that he wouldn't believe anything that either Law or Cardinal Egan in New York said. And I said, that's interesting. He actually referred to Cardinal Egan as Alpine Ed, and I didn't know what that meant. I thought that it probably meant that he liked to ski. And about a year later, someone said to me, "Do you know what they call them in Rome?" I said, "No." He said, "They call them Alpine Ed because he was such a climber." And I thought that was hilarious.
Oh.
But I guess.
Interesting.
So what's next for you?
Well, what's next for me? You know,
you're getting
I've been doing
married.
This for a long Well, I'm getting married, and I've got a beautiful wife to be, and I've also got a new home that we've purchased together, and I live now in the city itself, which is a whole new way to live. What's next for me is to fine tune and hone and try to continually do better at what I do. I have no desire to go elsewhere. I love the city, and I love the station. You know, people say to me, "You've been there 20 years," and I say, "Yes." And guess what? I'm one of the young kids here, because so many of our employees have been 20, 25, 30, 35 year employees. So it's a real heritage kind of place. Whether it'll be that way 10 years from now or 5 years from now, no one knows. But I'd like to continue and try to make a difference in a small way, and interview people who I've not had a chance to interview yet, and meet people and develop creative ideas to make the show a little more interesting.
You mentioned earlier the booking of your guests. You have had, since I've been listening to you, you've had authors, you've had musicians, you've had people that are interested in movies. You had the food show last night. How do you choose your guests, and how do you get them?
Well, it's so easy that I give this information out willingly. Guests are all over the place. Potential topics are everywhere, John, and they come to me. So in other words, authors and actors and publicity people come to me all the time. So it's more a case of what I turn down and then what I decide to use. But they give me pretty much total autonomy to book the show the way I want to book it, with the guests and the focus I want to use. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, deciding, oh, do I really want to do a segment on the history of this particular institution, or do I want to go something in sports that's a little different? And it's so much fun. It's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. And in the course of a five-hour show, I might have 6 to 8 different short segments and then some open line space. So it's totally eclectic. It's my choice. I do what I think works. And I've had the benefit of the audience that is there and responding. I mean, if the audience doesn't respond and your ratings are down and you're just not getting feedback, positive feedback, then you got to switch gears. So it took me several months to get my feet wet and understand what the audience was looking for. And I think I've got a pretty good beat on that right now.
Now, with the long term, or with the long Friday night show, do you have some people that are your 2 o'clock listeners and some that are your 1 o'clock listeners, or your 3 o'clock in the morning listeners?
Oh, you got it, John. That is, and you, I don't know where you fit into that, but you're one of my guys who calls every once in a while. I would say, yes, the rhythm of the night, if you will, is interesting. The midnight to 2, I would say, would be the people who are still up, still at them, not yet ready for bedtime, or if they're going to bed, they're on their way home. And then the 2 to 3:30 is the transition period, when you've got people getting up, going to bed, getting through work, arriving at work. And then from 4 o'clock or so to the end, that's when you have the early risers, and they're joining the party. We don't know exactly how many listeners we have, because the signal travels to 38 states, but we assume, based on the local ratings, and if you add them all up, is probably 250,000 or 250,000 people at any given time tuning in, which is a nice size audience. It's more than some of the cable networks have, but it shifts through the night. You're absolutely right. I mean, I can feel it, even though I'm in the studio and I don't see any lines ringing. I know what's going. I can feel that shift through the momentum taking place. It's really interesting.
I'm on the early shift, because I'm Saturday morning. I work in the local food pantry, which means I have to be up by 6:15 in the morning. So I'm on the early shift. Mm-hmm. And I listen to it now through an app on my tablet called Hot Radio. And mm-hmm. that is stations from all over the country, all over the world. It's not as well known as Tuned In Radio, but I get better reception on it.
And people then when are listening, yeah. Go ahead,
and then
go ahead.
When I call up, then I have you on the phone so I can hear it.
Yeah. It's amazing, you know, how cool the technology is. It's still radio, whether you hear it on the computer or you hear it on an old crystal set. It's still radio. It still, you know, leaves the microphone and the studio the same way, but it's transmitted differently. And because of that, you know, we've got people listening in Lithuania and China and other parts of the world who are expatriates, let's say. And it's fascinating, I mean, to think that the signal can come in crystal clear, you know, digital quality in, say, I'll just throw out a name, Honolulu, and that just blows my mind. Also, what blows my mind is the fact that a station like the one I'm broadcasting on, BZ, can be heard as loud and clear in, say, where I was this weekend, New Jersey, as it can be in Boston. I mean, I've been in Baltimore. I've heard it coming in just clear as a bell. So it's the nighttime signal. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and it's also that the digital receivers. I used to stay up with a friend of mine when I was young. I had one of these Grundig radios, one of these big things, and we could get all the way out to the Rockies, WO in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and all these stations, but you were limited on the ordinary radios by the band spread. There wasn't that much room between 1010 and 1050 on your radio. But now with the digital, you can get 1030. You don't have to worry about 1020 bleeding over, you know, or 1050 bleeding over. Did you ever get into the CB or to ham radio?
No, never. Well, I had a CB radio when I was a young driver, as many of it did. It was a fad. I didn't get into it. And no, not ham, but I have great respect for ham radio operators. In fact, we've had more than one show, maybe several shows over the years with ham operators and the benefit that they bring and the fun that they have. But I'm not a technical guy, so I never built my own little radio at home or my stereo. I don't know how things work. I just love the fact that they do.
I never did any of that either. We've touched a lot the bases tonight. What else might you like the audience to know about Jordan Rich?
Well, I think, you know, more than anything else, we all have our respective roles in whatever business we're in. And this is not to sound too corny, but and you've been listening to me for a while. I mean, I do firmly believe that it's important to serve the public in a way, in my case, that's entertaining them, that's amusing them, that's informing, and maybe even comforting. I think all of us need a sense of belonging, to know that someone is listening. Someone is listening. Now, it might sound weird because I'm hoping that people are listening to me, but I want people to know that I'm listening to them and talking not at them, but with them. And I've often, when I give talks in the area, I reflect a lot on how this job has molded and shaped me, and it changed me to a certain degree. It's made me more empathetic, understanding of people's needs. I can hear in the voice, because I've been doing this so long, when someone's troubled, when someone is fearful, or sometimes anger is just a cover for fear. And I'm not a psychologist. I don't play one on the radio, but I've really come to understand what it means to know people deeply and understand that just through the voice. And I think if more of us in the business that I'm in were able to get past the rhetoric and the nonsense and the screaming and just listen to people, we'd be in a much better place. So that's the one thing I hope to leave behind. I hope to create an atmosphere where people feel as though they're welcome and they're listened to.
Now, you mentioned that. What about the daytime superstation guys that are all over the Rushes and the Hannitys and all this, who scream at their audience and their audience screams at them? How do you handle that as the listener from what you just said?
Well, I listen, as you can imagine, to just about everything. And there's a place for that. I'm not saying that there isn't. They're very successful. They have huge audiences. people respond. There's absolutely no problem. I'm a big believer in freedom of expression and different formats to present expression. I'm just thinking that with the hours that I have and the powerful signal that I have, I can go one of two ways. I could be just another strident announcer, opinionated, asking for callers, arguing with callers. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. I choose to go the other route, and it's simply because I think I have a little too much sensitivity for people's feelings and needs, and I would probably not be the guy you'd want on the afternoon drive in New York, you know, running my mouth and getting people excited. That would not work in my book. I wouldn't really work well at that because it's just not who I am. So given the choice, I think Rush and Sean and all those guys are tremendous talents and serve a purpose, but that's them and not me. So I choose to go the other way.
What would you say their purpose is? Since you said they've served a purpose.
Well, I think provocative political talk, whether it's right or left, is good. I think, though, that people's issues, these issues are so complex that it's important to listen to other, if you can, to listen to other points of view. And there are limited numbers of, on talk radio, there's mostly conservative and to the right, you know, successful programming. There are some, however, that are broadcasting a different point of view, and I think it's a good idea to listen to both or explore both. I think on the cable side of things, when you have Fox on one end and MSNBC on the other, it's a pretty clear distinction between the two. Two points of view are mainly thrust at you. But what's the purpose? It's ultimately, John, entertainment. Ultimately, Rush Limbaugh, in my opinion, is a great entertainer. Howard Stern, like him or hate him, is an entertainer. And these personalities attract people to their shows, just as I hope I attract some people to my show. And it's like chocolate and vanilla. Yeah, there are many flavors, you know, and these individuals hit on something that works. And the only caveat is you have to be very careful about what you're listening to and know that it's the opinion that you're hearing. And maybe you should make your mind up after you've heard all the opinions, but that's up to the individual too. So
that's an interesting point. I think it was Quinnipiac College or Pew perhaps did a study, and only 4% of Hannity's listeners describe themselves as liberal, and only 6% of Rachel Maddow's listeners describe themselves as conservative. So all you're doing is you're reinforcing your own beliefs mm-hmm. over and over and over again, which probably isn't the best.
Yeah, no, it's probably not the best for the individual trying to make up his or her mind and being open about it. But they say that talk radio, the conservative talk radio led by Rush Limbaugh, has been the balance to the networks. And I'm not so sure that it's all true, but I think there is something to be said for the rise of talk radio on the right as a counter to what many perceive to be the liberal media, the left-leaning media in, say, the network news and many newspapers. But ultimately, it's entertainment. And if Rush Limbaugh or Sean or Kennedy or any of these guys were not good and attracting listeners, then they wouldn't have shows. And you have to deliver. You have to deliver performance, which ultimately is what it is.
Which you have been doing for 20 years, as you point out.
Well, I've been trying. Trying my best. I think the only thing I can say is I love what I do, and I think it comes across. If you have passion for anything in life, you're going to do it. You're going to lose yourself in the moment. And I am so blessed for all the struggles and stressors of life, and there are many. I'm so blessed to have the opportunity to do what I do on a big station that's a heritage radio station and follow in some great footsteps.
But I agree, and thank you very much, Jordan. It's been a real pleasure.
John, I love doing what I do on the air, but I also love being interviewed. It's a totally different vibe, and you're Outstanding at it. Thank you so much for the great questions.
Thank you. A bit of commercial information. My column now appears biweekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online and at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmacrants.com, and John McRance is JohnMacRants. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmac13, for the URLs of previous shows. Join us next week for Rotha Pagan Kennedy. And until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Oh, and rather than my local Lone Ranger theme, because of the current cold snap in the Northeast, I'll go off with a slightly warmer weather tune. Steady, Silver. I'm still with you anyhow. Go. Good night, everybody.